Humanitarian concerns play an important role in dealing with global security threats. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan late last year appointed a high-level panel to recommend UN reforms. In the second of his three-part series on the UN reform effort, Common Ground's Cliff Brockman talks with Johanna Mendelssohn-Forman of the United Nations Foundation and Robert Orr of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government about major humanitarian reforms they think should be included in the panel's proposals.
This panel is designed to focus on security threats. And one of the key security threats that we all woke up to after 9/11 was the fact that failed states, the weakest among us, could reach out and touch us in ways that we didn't expect. Afghanistan was not on anyone's radar screen, but that weak and failed state affected us in very direct ways. This panel has to confront the question of failed states. That will have huge humanitarian impact, because failed states aren't just a security threat. They're absolutely a humanitarian crisis. There is no such thing as a failed state that doesn't have a humanitarian crisis dimension. A second piece of the humanitarian puzzle, I think, is the question of disease and health. We've all gotten much more savvy about HIV/AIDS and how that affects us. And how health infrastructures around the world, whether it's SARS or HIV/AIDS, are an important part of increasing the security of all people around the world, including U.S. citizens. So if this panel addresses HIV/AIDS and more broadly health infrastructure around the world, it will have a positive security impact for all of us.
The international community has had some successes in the past decade with humanitarian intervention, for example, East Timor and Kosovo, but there have been some failures like Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia. How should the international community decide when they should get involved in humanitarian intervention? Is there a threshold?
I think that the international community has turned around on this issue in a 180-degree way. If we look at what happened in Kosovo, for example, there was a recognition that you needed to protect people in the wake of a military operation. So I think there have been, by ad hoc nature, certain abilities to use force bilaterally or in a coalition outside the UN, coupled with a strong UN response to protect once that particular military action has taken place. The other standards that could exist obviously relate to the political will of different nation states. We all remember the sadness of Srebrenica, where there was a peace operations going on there, and yet hundreds of people were murdered as a result of the inaction. So the standards are still not clear, but the movement of the global community towards an ability to protect and defend is certainly happening, and I think we see it each day at the United Nations, this growing will to do this.
I think we should avoid the temptation to define triggers too specifically. We don't want a threshold of 500 lives or 1,000 lives forces us to act. I think we have to look for developing norms that give us guidelines, but that don't kind of tie our hands to when we have to move. That could be used, as it was in the case of Rwanda, as a reason not to intervene. And then address the capacity issues for do we have the capacity to do something when we deem it necessary. In the case of Rwanda, we've debated endlessly over, you know, would 1,000 troops have been able to stop this? We won't know that.
Often a major step for intervening on humanitarian issues is the use of sanctions, but critics say sanctions often hurt the people they're meant to help or to assist, and that the government leaders don't really suffer when sanctions are applied. Are sanctions still a good idea, Johanna?
There's been a movement discussed recently about smart sanctions, sanctions that actually address the leadership as opposed to the population. But often they're not done in any effective or sequential way. And I think one of the most evident cases was in the past was in Haiti, where we imposed sanctions on a country that was already in a terrible state of poverty. It was probably the worst in the Western Hemisphere and among the worst in the world. And there the population continued to suffer. When sanctions began to shift towards the leadership by withholding visas, withholding access to the United States, with freezing bank accounts. You began to see movement and pressure on those people who actually controlled policies. Similarly, in the case of Iraq, we did have sanctions, which of course were in Security Council resolutions and were the rationale for going after Saddam Hussein in the war that was fought last spring. And at the same time, those sanctions, for Bob and myself, who both witnessed the impact of those sanctions, they were horrific, because the people of Iraq, who were an educated and fairly well-to-do country in the Middle East, became an impoverished country over the course of these sanctions.
One case of smart sanctions is that of Liberia, a very targeted set of UN sanctions on the leadership of Liberia that did help turn around the situation in neighboring Sierra Leone. It bit very hard on the government of Liberia when Liberian leaders and their families could not travel to the United States, that they had their bank accounts in the United States frozen. It did help to modify their behavior with respect to neighboring Sierra Leone. So I think smart sanctions, we still need to continue development in this area, but there is reason to think that that we can do this.
Robert Orr is with the John F. Kennedy School of Government. Johanna Mendelssohn-Forman is a senior program officer with the UN Foundation. Next week, I'll talk to Sweden's UN ambassador about the high-level panel and peacekeeping issues. For Common Ground, I'm Cliff Brockman.